On the Nonlinear Healing Podcast, we talk about all the aspects of healing. The beautiful parts and the painful parts, too. We acknowledge that healing is not linear, and there are many ups and downs in every person's story. And in fact, we celebrate the messy parts just as much as the pretty parts. This is Nonlinear Healing with Courtney Brooke. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Nonlinear Healing with Courtney Brooke. It's me, your host, Courtney Brooke. I am excited to dive into today's interview with Victoria Pelletier. She's a corporate executive, an author, and a public speaker. But before we dive in, I would like to give you all just a few life updates and a couple of quick announcements. So, if you're in a place right now where things feel like they're falling apart, you are not alone. We have just begun the eclipse season. So eclipses happen biannually, two times a year, usually around April and May, and then again later in the year in October and November. So this recent eclipse, this solar eclipse that we just experienced, was in the 29th degree of Aries, which, if you know anything about astrology, the 29th degree is always a very volatile and chaotic degree. So what this means is that shit is falling apart, especially if it's out of alignment. So in this moment, there is a lot of potential for transformation. If you find yourself in a place where things just don't seem to be working out, no matter how hard you're trying in one certain area, what I will tell you is this: excessiveness is not helpful in any respect, in any area. Yes, we want grit, but we also need discernment in when something needs to be let go of and when we need to rebuild. So this moment holds a lot of potential for transformation. Know that if things are falling apart right now, that it is happening for you and not to you. So if you're in alignment, I myself am in a place where finally this year is the first time I can honestly say I don't feel anything falling apart. It can still feel like there are bombs going off all around you. So it's really super important, whether you're in it or if you're just observing other people and their energies experiencing this chaos, this volatility, that you really stay grounded and centered through this energy. This is especially true because this is coupled with a Mercury retrograde right now. So Mercury retrograde tends to get a bad rep, but it can also offer us an opportunity to slow down, reevaluate, reflect, reexamine, redistribute our energy. So take things slow, don't overthink too much, and go with the flow. If something's falling apart, it's because it's meant to. A couple of quick announcements here. I want to thank everybody who made it out to the Curio Coven that was last evening. And what I will say is that it was an absolute success. We completely sold out the event. We had a wonderful group experience and ritual. And we launched the tickets for the next one, which is coming up on Sunday, May the 22nd at 7 p.m., and it is already halfway to sold out. So if you want to join us for a magical evening in May, make sure you grab your ticket ASAP, because this is a first-come, first-serve basis. Now, if we continue to sell out this quickly, I may be open to offering a second meeting each month, but shoot me a DM if you're interested in that. Right now we're meeting under the crescent moon, which is known as the witch's new moon. Maybe interested in putting a full moon in there. We will see. At any rate, we also have Exhale coming up this week on Thursday, and that is the 27th, I believe, right? Yes, Thursday the 27th. And Exhale is a community support group in which we meet for about 60 to 90 minutes of open discussion where we all have the opportunity to just sort of vent, talk about whatever is going on in our lives. And this is a moment for people to truly be seen and heard and not be bombarded with a bunch of advice. Now, if somebody asks for advice, yes, we will stop and give you advice. But knowing that you can come to this place without being overwhelmed with those you should tries and have you done's and all of those. And then we always wrap up each group with 20 to 30 minutes of relaxation practices, grounding strategies, those sorts of things. So again, that will be this Thursday. That is April the 27th at 6:30. Weather permitting, this will be our first meeting back in the yard. So we'd love to have you join us. Also coming up at the space this Sunday, April the 30th at 10 a.m., we have the Human Design Workshop. So this is a rebrand on Spirituality 101. If you're not familiar with human design, just know that it is a blend of a lot of different ancient modalities, including astrology, the I Ching, the Kabbalah, and the chakra system, all blended together to create what I affectionately refer to as the handbook on how to human. So gives you a lot of information about your energy type, how much you should be working, strategies for decision making, authority as far as how to make a decision. We're also going to talk about the various roles and what role you're meant to play in society if you're living in alignment. So pre-registration is required for this event and space is limited. So make sure you grab your slot today. All right, so Victoria Peltier, she is known as the Turnaround Queen. She is a corporate executive and author of Unstoppable, Stories of Changemakers Who Dare to Make a Difference. She has overcome significant childhood adversity, including childhood abuse, to become the most influential entrepreneur of the year in 2022. As stated by World Magazine. She has numerous other awards and recognitions among the tech and business industry. And most importantly, she has cultivated a resiliency in her life and inspires others to do so. So without further ado, help me welcome Victoria Peltier to the Nonlinear Healing Podcast. Welcome, Victoria, to the Nonlinear Healing Podcast.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
Well, I am very intrigued by your story, and I'm excited to share it with my listeners. I would love for you to start by just painting a backdrop, sort of set the stage for us and tell us a little bit about when you were born, where you were born, and a little bit more about your family.
Well, it's a good thing I'm comfortable sharing my age so openly. So I was born in 1976. So I will be 47 this year. Your listeners might detect the faintest bit of an accent. I'm originally from Canada, and so I was born in Ottawa, which is the nation's capital, actually. And interestingly, though, and you know, sort of paramount to my story and my journey is that I was born to a drug addicted teenage mother who was exceptionally abusive, pushing me upstairs, downstairs. One was not intentional, but her carelessness, a cigarette in my eye. So I wore patches for a number of months and went in and out of care. And she actually attempted to give me up a couple of times and took me back. And then ultimately the family that became my adoptive family, who would often have me after one of her episodes, asked to adopt me. And so I was fortunate to be adopted when I was around four or so. And my mom and dad are those that adopted me. Julie is my biological mother. And so my parents moved out to Western Canada during the oil boom. So I grew up in Calgary and went to school there and moved back to Eastern Canada, to Toronto and then New York, and now here in the US for many years since then. And so that those early years, I'd say, you know, really kind of formulated a lot of who I am today, my focus on being resilient. But I wouldn't say that the childhood was you know, all sort of sunshine in rainbows. My parents were from a lower socioeconomic class, my dad a janitor and my mom a secretary. So I started working very early. I'd say that I sought out desperately to be, you know, liked and included, I think, because I felt this big fear and of rejection given my early years. I made some poor choices, was raped in my when I was 14, and continued to have some challenge. And then, but again, I've sort of used all of that to propel me to, you know, what has, you know, what is current day in this, you know, the life of a corporate executive and now public speaker, using some of this past history and lived experience to hopefully help others, as I share so openly with your audience today.
Wow. I find it incredible the amount of resilience that you've had considering those early years. You know, I myself was also abused as a young child, and it took me a long time to, one, even come to terms with it, to even admit to myself, you know, that I maybe was different from other children and had experienced life differently. And for me, it really sort of warped my perception quite a bit. I found that fight and flight was very much a theme of my life in the early years before I really had understanding of what was happening. You know, very anxious as a child and things like that as well. So I'm just curious about, like, how do you feel that those early years impacted your worldview or impacted the way that you thought about yourself and others?
It's in so many different ways, honestly, Courtney. I think it's from, I had a tremendous amount of insecurity. Even I remember my mom saying at some point, I mean, kids always do stupid stuff and get in trouble, and that would happen. And, you know, she'd sit me down and, you know, sort of and say to me, Tori, like, you need to understand, like, we're not giving you away. Like, there's nothing you can do, you know, that would want us to hurt you or give you away. And that was, again, that, like, just incredible fear and anxiety and insecurity, given the person who should have, you know, cared for me, loved me the most, my biological mother, you know, that circumstance. So that there was a lot of deep seated, you know, insecurity that arose that, you know, I say manifested as I, you know, grew older into questioning myself constantly and this need to prove to the world that I was a success at whatever it was. Now, I'm fortunate that I did quite well in school. I was tested as gifted and skipped it a couple of grades. My mom was an amazing advocate for me. And so I had, you know, my school work ethic and grades to lean on, and then quickly leverage that into the work world. Like, I started working at age 11, in part because, you know, my parents, I never had food insecurity. There were clothes on my back, but they all came, my clothes came from Kmart. There was no money for me to go on school trips. So if I wanted anything additionally, I needed to work for it. But that was a place I felt I could, you know, something I could control. So whether it was my schooling or my work, I felt I had, for the most part, control over that, certainly how I performed. And I look back on that and I recognize that I had this desire to be better than either the biology that I was born into or the circumstance that I was raised within. And so that pushed me. So that's sort of one element. And then the other way it affected me is I erected these barriers or walls around me to protect myself. You know, one of my mottos is, and actually a title of a book I wrote is about being unstoppable. And you mentioned fight or flight. Like, I'm a fighter. There's nothing that's going to hold me back, but I had learned ways to protect myself and insulate myself from getting hurt. And that was to, you know, put up walls or push people away if I thought they were maybe going to do the same to me. And it took me many, many years to learn how to bring those down. And I also attribute my mom to forcing me to sit down and analyze why I was feeling the way I was feeling or why I would act out the way I was. And I hated it as a teenager, but I actually look back now and think that sort of self-reflection consistently is a big part of what's helped me move through what I'm going to say is an unhealthy level of being resilient to a much more healthy one, which can still feel the pain, can still feel emotions, but allows me to pick myself up when the obstacle or the challenge happens and like put one foot in front of the other and just focus on the end goal or outcome that I'm hoping to achieve.
Yeah. So what I'm hearing is you really sort of had this opposite response where some individuals, when they've gone through trauma, when they've gone through those abusive situations, in some way, shape, or form, they can actually adopt those qualities themselves, right? Where they internalize it and maybe they become part of this cycle. Sometimes they even end up being the aggressor and that fight response turns on in that way. But it sounds to me like your fight response was more of this reactive or basically the opposite effect. So having like the knowledge that like, this is the type of person that she was, this is the type of situation, your fight response was more of like, I'm going to do everything in my power to not be that way, to not have those qualities. Does that sound right?
Yeah. For me, what they talk about, the sort of proverbial, like breaking the cycle. And it was that way in so many facets of my life. Even like, I didn't drink. I've never done any kind of hard drugs. Like I've just because that's my biological mother did. So I have no, like, I've determined I'm really not going to be anything like that. And that's been my choice. And so it really was around, and I believe I'm not a like vision board person. That doesn't work for me. I know it works for some people, but you know, I set a goal or objective for myself and I am going to achieve it. And that was to, you know, be better than the, again, sort of the biological family or circumstance. I was not going to let anything stop me from achieving what I wanted. And in early on though, was I think I had felt like I had something to prove to the world. At some point, as I matured into, it probably was not even until like my late 20s or early 30s, where I was like, you know, I'm not proving for anyone else anymore. Right. So I wanted material things. You know, I became an executive very early. And, you know, with that, you know, came, you know, higher salaries. And at one point it was like, oh, I need a bigger house. I need a better vehicle and all these things. And it was because outwardly I had to prove something to the world. And that changed for me, you know, in my probably early 30s, where I'm like, you know, I'm no longer trying to prove anything to anyone else. It'll be for me, what kind of like lifestyle do I want and what really brings me great joy and happiness. And it's become much more around experience and the loved ones around me. But again, that was how I have like grown and evolved over time and what I thought I needed to heal or overcome circumstances. My thinking's changed a lot.
And this is a curiosity question, and maybe you know the answer to this, maybe you don't, but I feel always very intrigued by individuals who respond in the way that you do, meaning that like, I don't adopt the qualities that I see perpetuated, because typically that's how humans learn, right? So, you know, we encounter individuals who think and talk and act a certain way, and then we naturally sort of adopt that way. But then there are this subgroup of people where for whatever reason, they don't, right? Those circumstances, while they might have some effect, they're minimal. And I'm just curious, Victoria, like, why do you think it is that you were able to overcome those early circumstances to be so successful? Were there certain things that you were doing or certain people helping you along the way to kind of facilitate that?
My mom honestly was, you know, that person for me in my youth. Although interestingly, I mentioned I skipped a couple of grades. I graduated high school at 16. It was in my first year of university at 17 and moved out at that point and never lived back home again. My mom was diagnosed in later years as being manic depressive, what they'd probably call bipolar today. And so it was tough at home. So, but I still attribute her for one, taking me out of the situation, you know, with Julie and the circumstance. I probably would have been taken away formally by the child welfare system, but, you know, she took me out of that, but also she invested so much of her heart and her time into trying to you know, break down the hard shell of like my, of this little girl. And funny enough, my best friend, her nickname for me is Turtle, because she knows I've got this really hard exterior. I have dealt with a lot, you know, even into my adulthood, been able to shoulder a lot of adversity and challenge, but I'm really all soft and marshmallow inside. And I think my mom always knew that. And as I mentioned, I think I've gotten better at having this healthier level of resilience, that I actually think it was my mom who instilled that. But sadly, I don't think I had a lot of other great role models. You know, my dad, I don't think is a very good human. We haven't spoken in many, many years after my mom passed away. And instead I've chosen to leverage the experiences. I'm an avid people watcher, even like of that I see and how others act and behave. And I use that when it's negative as the model for me, even in the corporate world. I don't have a lot of great role models of like leaders who are the kind of like human-centered positive leaders that build great cultures. Instead, I've seen ones who are the opposite of that, and I model everything that they aren't. And so I've done that both in my personal and my professional life. And I also think there's a small element of it that, you know, must be embedded in my DNA somehow also to give me that kind of perspective. I think, you know, my younger one has bipolar disorder and struggles a lot. And, you know, she says to me, "Mom, you've overcome all this adversity and like you're able to be so successful and just move forward. And yet she finds a struggle." And I'm like, well, so I need to tell her, "Beauty, there's a difference in like mental health, medically," I said, "but in terms of how I move forward and different circumstance." But I also just think genetically, there's something in there that allows me to kind of have the fortitude to just pick up and move forward.
Yeah, it's very interesting to me. It's kind of that question of like genetics versus environmental, right? Where it's like, yes, I do think that there is a certain factor as far as the environment. Like, if you look at research, really, when it comes to resiliency, one of the most important things is having that one good person, having that person who's safe, who I can trust, who wants to help me. You know, that's an important factor. But then I do agree that there is this certain amount of maybe like a biological component as well. So we know that different bodies metabolize stress differently. I unfortunately didn't come from a family where we have the good allele, I guess, right? Like I, along with all the rest of my family, we have trouble when dealing with stress. Now that I'm aware of that, you know, I take supplements like ashwagandha that helps you metabolize stress more effectively and things along those lines. But I think that it is interesting to consider those factors. And because I think for some people, what can happen is they feel like they fall short, right? And like they could be comparing themselves, like, why is it that this person goes through all of these things and like I can't? Like what your daughter's doing, right? But understanding that like this is much more complex than just like this innate character thing, where it's not like there's not something wrong with you, but rather maybe it just means that you need to be even more proactive, that you need to consider even more, you know, how your choices are influencing your situation, things along those lines.
I think you used a great word, Courtney, around choice. And I think this is where a lot of people sort of get hung up in their ability to deal with the adversity and move forward, where there's a little bit of this thinking that it's just sort of fatalistic, right? It's fate, it's destined to happen, like that they have no control in the matter at all. And like, I think that's completely false. Don't get me wrong. I recognize there are circumstances and events that are out of our control at times. But for the most part, we make choice. So I think of, you know, so I was raped at 14. I was, put myself in a situation to date, or even before that, I think, you know, at 11, I started hanging out with the 15 and 16 year old boys and lost my virginity very early because I thought, sex equated to love. Again, that was a choice, and I understand that. And I made some choices. The one when I got raped at 14, maybe not so much my choice, but I'd had some poor, like, choices before that that might have contributed to it. To like a boyfriend who abused me when I was, oh, I don't know, 19 or 20 years old. You know, so all of those, I spent a lot of time reflecting back on what could I have done differently. And again, no woman ever chooses rape. So I'm not at all putting that necessarily in the same bucket, but the boyfriends that I've chose that were not great choices for me. Some of those was, again, who was I hanging around and who made me feel safe and whatnot. And so that, you know, that too, even in the work environment, you know, I put myself in, you know, situations and with roles and, you know, and work, you know, 70, 80 hours a week. But I, again, some of that in my early years was a choice to prove somehow my success in terms of my ability to deliver, and took more and more on. And so I think, yeah, a big part, I have this, you know, other phrase, or I sign a lot of my social media posts. The one word I said unstoppable, but the other is no excuses. And by that, I just mean choice. And it doesn't mean that, again, we don't feel emotion and pain, at the time, whatever has occurred to us, but, the no excuse comes in is that we can choose how we're going to respond to it. You know, how do we, you know, pick ourselves up and move forward? And with that, for me, that means anchoring back to whatever the goal or objective I had for myself was prior to whatever that incident occurred. And then recognizing, and, you know, the actions or steps that I need to take to move forwards on that. And that's where I think a lot of people can get sort of spun out. Like I see even with my younger one, and again, you know, some of that's the mental health condition, but who can spiral out of control and just, you know, as soon as something negative happens, not recognizing that, you know, they have choice in the matter to, you know, move forward in that. And so I think that's a big differentiator. And, but to your point, in some cases, many people need to take, might just be ashwagandha for you, but for others, it might be like my younger one who's taking, you know, a multitude, a cocktail of, you know, things prescribed by a doctor to help, you know, move forward with that.
Yes. Yeah. And, you know, when it comes to choice, I had a therapist years ago now who was a choice therapist. That was literally what his modality was called. And I think that for many of us, it feels like it's almost, what's the word I'm looking for? Like it can feel like an attack to say that, like, well, you chose to put yourself in a situation where you were at risk, or you chose to have too many drinks or to try this for the first time. And I think that, you know, there's some truth to saying that, like, not everything is a conscious choice, right? It's not like I have a history of addiction. It wasn't like I consciously chose, like, I want to be an addict. But in retrospect and looking back at those situations, you know, I chose unconsciously to do that. It was a subconscious part of me who just needed relief, just needed to escape. And I think that there's a certain level of accountability with that where you say, okay, so maybe this isn't conscious. Maybe this isn't a part of me that is like talking and things, but the feeling part of me, that subconscious part of me, did make that choice in that moment. And while it might have felt like I didn't have a whole lot of control over it, as long as I don't take accountability for that, then I remain powerless. Empowerment and resilience really stem from that sense of agency. And it's true, not everything that we do, we have agency over. Like, we don't have agency, like, we didn't decide about the pandemic. We don't get to decide about the recession and things like that. But on a day-to-day basis, focusing on what it is that I can control, where I do have agency, where I can have choice, that's where those feelings of empowerment come from that ultimately lead us to creating a life that we did choose. Because trauma is not our fault, but healing is our responsibility.
Right. I agree very much so with everything you've said, Courtney, on that. And as you said, I actually just love the way you phrase that around, you know, trauma is not our fault. Healing's our responsibility, very much so. And also that I think a lot of the things, as you said, we do are, you know, unconscious. Like I can look back now and recognize in my teens, I, you know, I did things, I didn't know at the time why I was doing it. And I can look back and go, you know, I was doing it to fit in, to be liked, to feel loved, and, you know, could recognize, you know, that. And even into my 20s, again, I found sort of a, you know, probably this 5 or 6 year period in my like late 20s, early 30s for me, kind of the most formative, where I could be so incredibly self-aware and reflective, and then start to recognize early signs as I felt something, so that it no longer was unconscious anymore. And how I then made the conscious decision to lean into a different thought, a different action or behavior that wasn't always comfortable. But I think without discomfort, the change and the growth won't come.
Yes, absolutely. It's making that subconscious conscious. And I know you mentioned at one point around, you know, some sexual trauma. There was maybe some violence at some points. And I want to just go back and highlight that a little bit. And I'd like to talk a little bit more about those experiences, because, you know, I found myself in similar situations where, you know, I didn't choose to like be date raped, but I put myself in a situation where the likelihood was there. And I, for me, like subconsciously, it's very clear now, like looking back at that situation, very much this theme of like, I just want to be liked. I just want to be loved. I want to feel something. And, you know, I think that sex is always an exchange of power. And when we're not aware of that exchange, a lot of times it's us who are losing our power in that moment. So I'm just curious, you know, what you think about that, and maybe just telling the audience a little bit more about what those experiences were like for you.
Yeah. So for me, I lost my virginity by choice quite young. And I recognize I did it because I know the exact summer when it occurred. And like, I was so desperate to fit in and be liked, you know. So my best friend and I at the time hung out with these older guys who all like smoked, and I was so against smoking, but I like smoked on occasion cigarettes to like, again, be cool, and hang out. And one of the guy was like 15 or 16 years old. And I'm like, oh, you know, let's go into my, you know, garage that has a couch. And I'm like, so I did it by choice. And I can look back and I'm like, I didn't really want it, but I felt like it, again, I was going to fit in and like, you know, be loved. And I remember having it, I told my mom shortly afterwards. And so she helped me kind of process and talk through a lot of the choices I was making, so that when I was 14 years old, and dating, an 18 year old, I didn't want to have sex. I did it that one time before, and like, that was it. But again, he was older, and maybe because I'd allowed, like we were kissing and I allowed it to get to a certain point. But when I said, no, I don't want to go any further, that's when he raped me. And again, we will never blame a vape rape victim for that. But again, I know that that probably wasn't wise for me to have him, you know, home alone in that circumstance and allow anything to begin that then progressed to the point that it did. You know, and so again, not my fault that it happened, but it caused, you know, me to be much more mindful there forward. And again, I do attribute my mom, who's again, you know, talked to her about it. She was, you know, amazing around, you know, what happened. And, you know, we spent hours and hours upon hours kind of, you know, through the choices I was, you know, making and how I was feeling that put in and how I got into the, you know, the situation I did, to prevent it from occurring again. And I don't even think, although it certainly helped in the moment in those years later, as I, you know, dated beyond there. But again, I actually think it was much later in life, probably a decade later, before I was like really appreciated, all of the effort and the conversation that I remember hating in the moment as a teenager.
Yeah. And, you know, again, I think I have to echo you in saying that I never, ever would blame a rape victim for being in that situation. I think instead, you know, it's shitty. Like, let's be honest, like, it sucks that we live in a world where we have to teach our girls how to protect themselves rather than living in a world where we teach our boys, you don't ever put your hands on a girl like that, or you don't ever do that to a woman. Right. But this is far from an ideal world. And I know for myself, when I revisit those situations where things transpired and they shouldn't have gone that way, or I didn't want them to go that way, you know, I look back and I go, okay, if I were really listening to myself, if I were really listening to my intuition in that moment, you know, I knew that I shouldn't have trusted that person, or there was something inside me that never felt comfortable with him. Right. And I kind of overlooked that part of myself, or dismissed that part of myself, for the purpose of wanting to fit in, wanting to be cool, wanting to be liked. And, you know, that's one of the things that, well, first of all, I teach my boy that you don't ever, like, if a girl says no, then that's it, right? Like, that's the end of the story. But also, you know, teaching our daughters to listen to your intuition, to trust your gut, and to know that it is your body, and consent isn't just not saying no. Consent is feeling full yes with my body, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I've had, you know, conversations with both my children about that. My older one is a son, my younger one daughter, although actually she's looking to transition to male. She's just talked about that over the last few months. So I'll soon need to start saying, get comfortable saying I have two sons, but I've had the conversation with each gender of my child around the, you know, what it's like, and the, you know, conversation, you know, has been, as you said, very, very different. And you know, the risks associated with it. So again, you know, what the conversation I had, you know, with my son, I mean, well, even I bought him his first box of condoms, even around, you know, to make sure that he's prepared, but, you know, talking to him about what does that look like? What is consent as I sent him off to college, you know, to just be prepared for all those kinds of things. And quite honestly, fostering that kind of conversation with both my children, that they would be comfortable coming to me, and asking questions, and, you know, just gaining a better understanding before they themselves put themselves, in a poor situation.
Right. There's another part of your story that I want to highlight a little bit, where you mentioned that you were a meticulous student, very advanced, even being able to skip ahead in grades. And I can relate to that in a lot of ways. For me, I think a lot of that was anxiety-based. So a lot of this performance fear, right? I just wanted to be the best because I felt safest. And so I'm curious for you, you know, where do you think that sort of stemmed from? Like, was that a place of anxiety or comparison, or where do you think that came from?
Well, it's interesting. Sometimes I wonder, you know, where the IQ and the brains came from a biology perspective, right? Again, looking at my, you know, biological mother who made exceptionally poor choices. And then, although I never knew my biological father, I believe he's a taxi driver. Not that there aren't really intelligent people that drive taxis, but it just, neither one of them appeared to have significant, although I do know my biological mother's side of the family. I think there's like a psychiatrist, and one of her other sisters is a, you know, professor. So, you know, there's some brains that run in the family. So I think some of it honestly came naturally, and I am really fortunate for that. The other is this, I do have a very competitive drive. So it's probably my competitiveness probably amplified as I grew older. I mentioned it earlier as just a way to, you know, prove success in my, and be liked. Although actually being smart, it actually had an opposite effect with a few of my teachers who didn't quite know how to handle my giftedness when I was in elementary school. And it didn't garner me a lot of friends. Now I think being smart and getting good grades in school is probably much more well regarded, and you're not ostracized. But as a kid, I actually was made fun of for it, for being the teacher's pet, for being finished first, all of that. It didn't actually significantly improve for me until I did end up skipping grades. But it, then my drive was, yeah, I want to stay at the top. If, you know, I was not the most popular, so I'm going to at least prove it by my grades. Like, I'm going to earn a different kind of status here in school. And I don't like to not do well at things. So that, you know, that drove me as well. And that's kind of continued into the work world. And as I said, I always felt like it was a, you know, a place that I could control, like my own performance in my work ethic, whether it was in school or in a corporate setting, I could control. And so it gave me, you know, greater comfort overall.
Yeah. And it sounds like it was another piece of that, like, agency for you, where it was like, I can feel this sense of like control and completion. Like, I'm the one in charge here, versus, you know, maybe a lot of those early circumstances where you didn't have a whole lot of control. Now I know for me, and I think I heard this echoed in your story too, that eventually that place actually led me to quite a bit of burnout, where at one point, you know, I was a senior in my undergraduate. I was taking 18 credits. I was working 30 hours a week. I had just found out that I was pregnant with my firstborn with my, you know, then boyfriend, now husband. And I just was go, 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 go. Didn't matter. I'm graduating summa cum laude. I mean, there were points where I was a research assistant and I was so sick from morning sickness that I would lay on the floor in the lab in between the clients. And never once would I call off. Never once would I give myself a break because of the high expectations that I held. So I'm just curious if any of that played a role for you as well.
It did. I it's funny because I have been asked, I became a corporate executive really early. So I started working at 11, like by 14, I was the assistant manager of my shoe store. Like, while I was in university, I worked for a bank and got promoted up through the ranks. So by 24, I became the chief operating officer of a company, an outsourcing company. And I was, my firstborn child was only a few months old. And so for me, it's like, no one's going to tell me that I can't do something. And in this case, I always knew I wanted to be like a mother. I was an only child. My adoptive parents never had any other children. So, you know, I knew I was going to have multiple, but I also knew what I wanted to achieve from a career perspective. And I was unwilling to compromise on either. And although I didn't burn out, I think I've always had an exceptional capacity. I could see how I could have. Like, there was years and years and years when I operated only on like 4 hours of sleep. Because I'm also a fitness fanatic. So I would get up and I would work out and be at the office by 7:30 and, you know, work a full day and come home and be with the family and then work again after the kids went to bed. And I was also traveling a lot and to do this all over again. And so I felt the load. I never got to a point of burnout, but it's been a lot to handle. And I'm sure is weighed, you know, heavily on my mind and body, because those were the choices I made.
Yeah. And I think for me, my body registered my pushing myself to the edge way before my mind ever did. I mean, I was there again, working at, combine all the things, maybe 70, 80 hours a week while I was 6 months pregnant. And my body was the one that really started to be like, listen, you can't keep doing this. I had a very traumatic birth. I was very, very sick afterward. I had a very long recovery versus my mind that was sort of always just, oh, this is fine. Like, you can handle this. You can handle anything. Right. But our bodies they're not able to lie to us, I guess, in that way, where it's like, they show the signs and symptoms of ongoing chronic levels of stress. You know, cortisol does take a toll in that way.
Yeah, exactly. I agree. And I think that's why, you know, it's at some point later in life, I often spend a lot of time, doing career, you know, counseling or mentoring others. And, you know, one, this notion of you can have it all. And I say, you can, not all at the same time. And then the second is getting really clear on what I use the word joy, like what does not bring you personal or professional value or joy. We just need to learn to say no to. And now there's going to be things that still have to get done, right? Our laundry and our houses need to still be clean. And so you know, make your spouse do it, agree that you'll share those duties, or you outsource it, you know, or at work you delegate and these sorts of things. And that's how I've gotten much more effective at having it all. It does come with trade-offs, but it also means you gain comfort in saying no at times.
Yeah. And, you know, having those boundaries. And I think one of the things that I've really sort of learned, now I'm 30 this year, so I'm still, you know, along my journey here. And, but what I've really learned is when I say no, and when I set those boundaries, really, I'm allowing space for the things that matter more. And, you know, I've had to say no to things like helping extra with the PTA, or, you know, doing maybe like a volunteer project with the council that I'm on, because I need the time, the space, and the energy in other areas. As time and energy are not infinite resources. So I'm just curious, you know, what are some of the things that you have maybe had to set boundaries around or had to do in order to manage your time and your energy?
I'm sadly, I've like lived by my phone, my calendar on my phone, you know, so frequently. A big part of, you know, being in the corporate world or otherwise means like living by a strict schedule. And so for me, you know, it's, you know, sad when, you know, you're talking to a friend, I'm like, oh, let me just see when I can fit this in. But I have been very disciplined about blocking time, for example, for working out. And so I found out there was probably only about 2 years in my life where I kind of let that slip. I think it was when right after I'd given birth to my younger one. And I was also traveling so much and I put on a bunch of weight, and it was also traveling, you know, eating out a ton, but also wasn't working out. And so I got really good at that point then at saying, no, like this is my protected time. People were booking me for calls at 7:30 in the morning. And I said, no, like my calendar's blocked before 9 a.m. And, you know, from 9 to 5 is when, you know, I will take calls. And it doesn't mean I don't take calls before or after that. I've been in, you know, global roles where you're working on multiple time zones, but protecting certain time. And then it's by exception only for someone to book around that. Also around, you know, carving time for, I'm a big, you know, networker and spending time to do coaching and mentorship. So I block my, you know, an hour, you know, for lunch, longer pre-pandemic when there was more going out to do that versus Zoom meetings. And then also even just like 2 30-minute blocks in the day to allow me to catch up on emails, because I'm back-to-back-to-back calls and I don't want to be doing it all at nighttime. So it's things like being really disciplined around that. And I have this saying, you know, where there's conviction, there's capacity. So going back to kind of this no excuses and choice thing, like if you have conviction around doing something, whether it's being healthy, whether it's kind of this, you know, side hustle or business that you want to get off the ground, well, then you have a choice. Like you're not going to Netflix until 11 or 12 or 1 a.m. You know, you're going to stop and, you know, focus on that. And so that discipline, I've always had a high level of discipline, has helped. But then also just creating time in a calendar, if that's what it is, to get it done, has helped me immensely.
Yes. Yeah. And protecting your time is so difficult to do sometimes, you know, as a working mother. But I love that quote, you know, where there's conviction, there's capacity. And I'm going to be carrying that with me, because I think that's really powerful and very true. So Victoria, I'd like for you to just maybe name some of these specific tools, some of the specific strategies that you've had along your journey that have helped you to come to the place that you are now. So, you know, any specific modalities or therapies, anything along those lines?
I think being incredibly self-aware and reflective. And again, you've heard me say a number of times that my mom taught me that, but I do that now. Like even there was an experience, you know, with a, I left one company and went to another, and I realized quite quickly I didn't enjoy. I'm like, okay, I'm the common denominator here in between both of these environments. And what is it about me? And it turned out it's some of it was around the culture of the organizations, but it's also around the type of work I like to do. But it was me sitting and reflecting. Again, I'm not going to blame anyone else but me. Let me be reflective over how am I contributing to this situation. So being really self-aware, self-reflective is one of those things. The other is, you know, for me, I need to say things out loud. Find your trusted group or tribe around you that you can do that with, not only to talk things through and say things out loud, but in some instances we do still have blind spots. We talked about, you know, the things that are, you know, unconscious or subconscious to us, and others will have a better lens to see that than we. So find those people that you trust who you could have the conversation with. I know for me, at the end of my workday, for example, it's now my husband and my other one is my best friend. Like, those are my two people. And you know, they, you know, get the download. And many times with my husband, I, you know, say to him like, babe, I'm not looking for advice. I just need to, you know, say it out loud. And that helps immensely for me. I'm not one that has gone to counseling, but I've recognized its value for others. You know, sadly, my ex passed away, and I had both my children in grief counseling within 2 weeks of their passing to help them through their journey. And then later, actually, for my younger one, you know, through what then we identified as a broader mental health issue. And so I've seen the benefits of that for others, although I haven't utilized it for myself. And then some of the just self-care. So fitness for me, my gym time is a really big component of that. That's my time where I can think, where I can listen to music or podcasts or audiobooks, or just people watch. But like that for me is my time. And then other things that just make me feel really, you know, good. So I love music. I joked about being a people watcher, but I am. And so getting time with my husband to go and step away from my desk to go and do those things. I just got a dog again. I hadn't had one for many years because life was busy and it wasn't fair to a dog. But now that my kids are older, like, you know, even that for me is, you know, just, it's brought me, I use the word joy, but so much joy to have this little guy like in my life. And so those are the things that have worked for me. I said earlier, like, a vision board isn't it. I'm very clear on my goals and objectives, but I know it works for others. Or I'm just seeking professional, you know, help can really work for others. Even if I didn't utilize it, I recognize, you know, how much it can help others.
Yes, absolutely. Different people need different things. And, you know, not everybody is going to benefit from the same tools. So if individuals want to follow you, Victoria, if they want to learn more about you, if they want to work with you, how would they do that?
Well, I'm on almost all the platforms, although my youngest tells me I'm not cool because I'm not really on TikTok or Snapchat, but you will find me. I have a website, which is victoria-peltier.com. I'm assuming it'll be in your show notes, so I won't spell the last name. But I'm also on LinkedIn. And I've got public pages on both Facebook and on Instagram.
Wonderful. And any last words of advice for a listener who's still along their healing journey? What would you say to maybe inspire them along that journey?
You know, that we're all the, let's call it the CEOs of, you know, in my case, brand Victoria, and they are of their own lives. So I think, you know, do not ever let anyone tell you how far and wide, you might be able to go. You know, you can have your own version of whatever the unstoppable journey or life looks like for you. And it's very different and it's going to change and you might pivot over time, and that's okay. That's what happens when we grow, but we're very much the CEO. We are in charge of that. So be confident in taking control, and as you and I've talked about, in making the choices for you that are right for you and moving forward, not just for healing, but for whatever your goals and objectives are.
Wow, everybody. I hope that you enjoyed Victoria's interview today. If you enjoyed today's story, make sure that you share on social media and tag Victoria and I. If you haven't already, leave a review for the podcast. That's how we help spread these messages to get the word out, and it's super important for our growth. So thank you so much for joining us today on Nonlinear Healing with Courtney Brooke.